So Maze is screaming again. You have food, you little nightmare.
Maze is that the rich kid at school who owns a clubhouse and all this stuff, but never satisfied, and just wants attention.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds extremely true. I love him, but he has a terrible personality.
ain't that the way? There's thing about having a terrible personality that makes people sparkle, and cats sparkle.
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
I know Maze is the name you settled on, but he would do great as a James Dean the cat.
He is 17. He's not going to get renamed at this point, but you are not wrong that he has that movie star quality.
The cats at our place, they just sleep, and they knock over my stuff, but they really want to get in my room, because I eat in my bed, and they know that, so they just want to vulture all the random bits of food that are probably in this mess I call home.
They're like little scavengers.
Scavengers actually know what is good for them to eat, but I don't think cats...
That's a pretty strong statement about scavengers on the whole. I think if all opportunistic feeders were that good about knowing what they should and shouldn't eat, we wouldn't have to worry so much about sea turtles being full of plastic.
That's fair. I just think scavengers know something we don't. Like, you shouldn't have to pay for food, nor should you have to look too far for it.
That doesn't sound like something that people don't know. That just sounds like they aren't subject to capitalism.
Capitalism. How was your 4th of July? Speaking of.
You know, I went down to the waterfront, as one does. There were some kids dancing. They brought one of those little portable speakers that I guess you can have now, because technology is a miracle, and they were taking turns recording each other dancing for, I guess, Facebook fucking Live. And honest to God, my first thought was like, oh, just like in Step Up. Did you do shit for the 4th?
I found free burgers and hot dogs at a theater, and it was weird. It was fun, but it was weird. This theater had a barbecue and free beer. And then I just sort of let Uncle Sam guide me, and I watch fireworks on a rooftop.
Sounds very, you know, 4th of July. Sounds like you were in the spirit of the holiday. Oh, shit, that reminds me. Sorry, I'm validating your experiences, but also let me talk shit for a second. At the fucking Portland fireworks, there were some fucking New York City people talking loudly about how much better and more interesting New York City fireworks are, and how they missed rooftops and watching fireworks on rooftops. And they were so fucking loud. And every other sentence out of their fucking mouth was about how they were from New York City. And I know you're not from New York City and you just live there now, but I'm holding you personally responsible for what those people are like.
It sounds like they did their job. That's like every emissary from the city has to say we're better and then describe how we're better and be as loud as possible about it.
It was so annoying. I'm not one to complain. That's not true. I complain all the time. Let me specify.
My eyes you're not in the back of my head.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not one to complain about people talking in public. I talk during movies. I don't give a shit. God is fucking dead. But I do think if you're taking in free fireworks, shut the fuck up.
When we get some, yes, I'm using we now. because I have to apparently claim ownership of my burgeoning New Yorkness.
Yeah.
When we get free things, we also want an experience. Because free is not enough.
What part of fucking overlooking a scenic ass river as fireworks happen and, like, wholesome youths dance nearby is not an experience? That's a fucking experience.
Was there free food?
No.
There you go. There it is.
Let me just say, I hate your fucking city and all the people it spews out to the rest of the world. I realize you haven't even lived there that long. But, like, you're the most convenient person to blame right now.
That will not be the first time I hear that. Probably today. It's fair.
It's probably not fair, but it's what's happening.
I mean, I, like every red-blooded American, cannot wait for the city to sink below the sea. And now, just all cities, honestly. But, you know, we're scrappy, and we like what we like, and we're going to be loud about it, because goddamn it, New York is the greatest city in the world.
Well, it's certainly a loud one. I'm glad New York has you to advocate for it.
They should really fucking pay me.
They should. If we can get the trade sponsored by the New York City Tourism Board or whatever, that would be good shit.
Just the banner, just us, our faces, everywhere. Now I'm fantasizing.
It'd be good, like, I'm a Mac, I'm a PC style advertisement where you're like, I love New York City. And I'm like, I hate this rat infested hellhole. And that's the tourism board.
A lot, I think they would go for it, honestly.
I think New Yorkers would respond to I hate this rat infested hellhole in a really proprietary and proud way where they'd be like, yeah, but there are rats. And then the rats would shout at me about how, like, the fireworks in New York City are better and how they miss rooftops as rats. I feel like New York City rats are probably as obnoxious as New York City people. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it's. Have you ever heard rats yelling at each other?
No, the rats down in Portland are pretty quiet. They mostly just hang out near the Crust Punks in front of that one bookstore. Not Powell's.
Oh. Are the rats a part of the Crust Punks?
I don't think they're affiliated. I don't think they belong to the Crust Punks. It's that the Crust Punks and the rats both hang out in front of this empty lot next to this bookstore. And whenever I walk past, there's, you know, rats scurrying around out from under the fence, and Crust Punks just sitting in front of the fence. It's like a little ecosystem of Crust Punks and rats.
The circle of life. Circle of subcultures.
I think there's a Husker Du song about that. Anyway, read any comics lately?
I actually have.
Hell yeah.
For once. I went to Midtown and I picked up. So, Clue, they're making a Clue comic book based off the eponymous board game and much beloved movie. And it's done by IDW. And I don't like adaptations usually, but I'm a sucker for anything Clue related. And I gotta say, it was good. There's only one issue so far. It's your standard murder mystery narration by a butler. Weird, weird, stupid jokes about mustard and affiliations. An old lady gets, I'm just gonna say who gets murdered, right? So obviously Mr. Body gets murdered.
Yeah.
And then, he invites all these people over. They have, for some reason, there is an Australian rapper there.
What?
Yeah, they really went, like, most of the pieces are cool, Colonel Mustard, Professor Plum, and then I forget which one they are. Miss Scarlet, for some reason, is a Aussie rapper who is there to entertain the party after dinner.
Okay.
Yeah. So that sort of killed my buzz a little.
Is that supposed to be an Iggy Azalea reference? Is that what they're doing here?
I think it's a very, very blunt Azalea reference, yeah. And her beef is with Mr. Green, who is a hedge fund manager turned pharma bro, who is, of course, everyone's favorite person to hate, the Martin Shreks.
Yeah, Shrek himself.
Martin Shrekle Lee. Fun fact, I thought he was a new Shrek character for a very long time. I did not know he was a real awful person.
He's so real, and he's back in the news because they couldn't get any jurors for his case because everybody fucking hates him.
That's one way to skirt the law, I guess.
Right? If you want to make sure that you get a mistrial, make sure that everyone hates you so fucking much that the American justice system can't fucking function. And I
I
guess,
hope.
be white so that you actually benefit from the justice system. That probably helps as well. But like, those two factors combined.
That's amazing. I'm so glad the wheels of justice are still broken.
Yeah, it's great. It's super good that that happened.
The art is good, but it's not very. It's nothing special. It's just sort of like your standard.
Yeah, serviceable American style cartoon realism.
Yeah, they do have some good like close-up face stuff. Like they do the expressions well, and they do blood well, which I'm a great fan of. The macabre. Look at that face.
That's a hell of a face.
Look at that blood.
Yeah.
She dies.
Oh, good for her.
And for anybody listening, if you haven't seen Clue, you should see the movie before you read the comic. Because I don't think the comic is going to be as good as the movie.
The movie's a modern classic.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't think it's gonna live up to the movie, but it's a pretty fun comic.
It's a fun comic. Like, it's worth the read if you like silly jokes and murder. It looks like they do an interesting thing where they have at the end of, I don't know if it's just because it's the first issue, but they do have clues throughout the book that sort of point to who the murderer is. And at the end, like when there's usually a preview of a affiliated comic or the press that's doing another. They decided to put another piece of the puzzle in and do like a rewind back time, sort of like they did in the movie when they didn't show anything too interesting, but it did show like an actual clue, which I like.
Nice.
There's a possibility. I like stories where there's a possibility of you being able to figure it out before the end.
Yeah, if they're gonna construct a mystery, there is something appealing about it being sort of set up to be solvable. I think probably especially
And I know sloppy claims about, like, something is especially true in print or something is especially true in television are usually not very useful. But I do think with serial print media, it does have the advantage that you can go back and revisit, and the way that it's spaced out invites you to do more thinking about than, like, with a single-episode mystery TV show, where you have less ability to, like, page through and find particular spots easily. I do think the sort of attention given to the notion of agency in comics as readers is overstated, but it definitely is true that you can spend more time lingering or buzzing past something more deliberately, more easily. You can now do those things in television thanks to the magic of, like, remote controls, I guess, and Netflix, Netflix and equivalents. But print media makes it easier. It's easier to do things like look closely in any sense. So that and space between issues is a real incentivizer to, like, clue finding and mystery solving, because I think clue finding is a pretty natural fit with reading of all kinds.
It's that sweet, sweet narrative device. keeps you coming back. I like feeling smart. It's very hard to find things, especially in media, that make, that actually are like, you know what, I trust you, you can, we'll give you some clues, we trust your own thoughts, and we think you're smart enough that we don't have to lead you. Don't get me wrong, there are parts of this that are very condescending, but it's not as condescending as most things.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think a lot of texts, print or otherwise, are interested in that solving dynamic. It's more in their interest to tell the story of somebody else solving it rather than, like, have readers solve it. So reader engagement is always meant to be thwarted to a certain degree. Or if not thwarted, because engagement means a lot of different kinds of things. It's just not set up so that the most rewarding path is solving the mystery. Viz, even though it's very rewarding to try to suss shit out about both, to think of the two classic examples of prestige television with mysteries in them, as opposed to mystery television, which is a whole separate shebang, Game of Thrones and Twin Peaks. It's very rewarding to be like, well, but who is Jon Snow's mom and or dad? Even though the answers to that are, like, no amount of solving will make it more possible to know, or, like, more likely that you'll have the right answer than whatever the voice of God hands us down. And yeah. Similarly, Twin Peaks, I don't think any amount of being very clever, even though Lynch content rewards revisiting and revisiting and revisiting, I don't think any amount of being clever would give you demon-possessing Leland if you were not handed that.
Right. It's the red herring.
Yeah.
It's a red herring.
So even though it's satisfying to try to solve those problems, and that's one kind of engagement, you ultimately can't solve that problem, and you're not really supposed to. And I think, I wasn't sure it was Lynch on record saying this, but I was reading somewhere that, like, you're not really, that's not supposed to be the point of Twin Peaks. You're supposed to be along for the ride, exploring the city. So, condescending, not condescending, definitely relevant, and definitely it's very possible for a text to lead you by the hand and be like, here's the point, you numbskull, or for a mystery that does ask for certain kinds of mystery-solving engagement, usually mysteries qua mysteries, will be like, here's the point, you numbskull, here's the answer. And others will be like, you just don't have that information, later, chump. And I'm, like, mostly thinking about Inspector Lewis again, because I have never not thought about Inspector Lewis for more than, like, 20 consecutive minutes.
It's, You really like that show, huh?
I love it so much. It's maybe the only thing I love uncomplicatedly. And that's only because I've willed all complications away. I'm like, I just don't give a shit. I'm just gonna love it. But, you know, some people feel that way about their children or people they wed or their pets. I'm like, eh, all of those things seem very complicated to me. I'm just gonna love this television show. Anyway, you know, and that'll vary between episodes or whatever. And I'm sure the same is true with your old main lady, where some of them are solvable and some of them are just not solvable.
You mean Dame Angela Lansbury and Murder, She Wrote?
That's the one, Jessica Fletcher, old lady from Maine.
Yep. Murder, She Wrote does the... Yeah, sometimes they're solvable. A lot of the time, they just show the murder first, and they're like, well, how's Jessica gonna figure this out? And the whole time, you're like, it's this person. And Jessica's like, shh, just give me time. Dude, I got one other thing.
Okay.
Did you read comics?
I did. I read a single comic, which I am sitting on, I guess. ITDN 10 Comics by Andrew Burkholder, 2010 to 2014, with an introduction by the author. It's from that 2D Cloud Kickstarter a while back, the one where I mailed you my extra copy of one of the things that they sent me by accident, because they did that. And it's very 2D Cloud. I think 2D Cloud is a company that has a very strong sense of what they are, even though their work is, or the work they put out is fairly diverse. I think they also prioritize abstraction, and they prioritize conceptual work, and ITDN is certainly that. There's a spiel on, I think it's on the inside fucking cover, to give you a sense of what this text is like. The inside of the dust jacket has the Universal Oblivion written on it, and then a bunch of text that sounds like it comes off of fucking Dr. Bronner's soap bottle, and then a picture of this duck shape with various outline or various fills on the inside and outside of it, which, like, I guess that's comics. Like, you've delineated an inside space and an outside space. And you've toyed with what those boundaries are. So, like, good job, it's comics.
He comics hard.
ITDN was my attempt at branding a lived experience. My supposed lived experience. An experience with no consistency, apart from line break he. So, the, but like, look at me, I'm too good to line break, actually. When the word end, I just line break right in the fucking middle of it, because this is art. With the title attached to it, ITDN. Andrew Burkholder, in quotes, was never explicit in this work. By attaching my name, by publishing this book, I've given up the luxury of anonymity, the freedom of not being accountable for a body of work. The author can supersede the expectation, which is also broken, like, right in the middle of the word. Or indeed, no, it's one letter before the end of the word. So not in the middle, but also, like, in the middle of the word. Of the expectation of ideological homogeneity, and pursue any experience they desire by being anonymous. By attaching Andrew Burkholder to these pieces, the universal power of ITDN, an acronym that never stood for anything, has been destroyed. Now it's just the title of this book. With which I have several contentions.
I've heard that.
I do think, I think it's a very interesting text. I think I like several of the texts in it. It's a little, as it says in the title, it's 10 comics by Andrew Burkholder. It's in more or less different levels of abstraction and narrativity. So the introduction has that duck shape come back. And it's more or less a discourse on art. Through most of the text, I would say, it's explicitly a discourse on art, starting from the introduction, which talks about the mind surpasses its limit with so much force that an entire world, external in appearance, becomes under its control. An object which is not an object, and there's just some lines. So it's that kind of text, which, like, I'm interested in engaging with, but also, you know, it sets a certain tone for how they want this book to be received. And it is not in the interest of accessibility.
No, it seems like abstract is the name of the game.
So they then have, the next one, is two artists, presumably, because it opens on their naked torsos playing rock, paper, scissors.
Okay.
So I think we're asked to see them as one man and one woman. And one goes on a journey into themselves and makes some pieces according to that, and one stays in the studio and works. And they have some disputes, and then some improbable plot events. At one point, there's some guy with a dead Kennedy shirt who tries to shoot them. That's probably the least abstract of the comics that follow. And I'm not going to belabor the point by summarizing all of them, but that should give you a sense of the ways that it's very explicitly interested in a fine art context, that it's very explicitly interested in doing things with panel forms, doing things with narrativity, and doing things with juxtaposition. Well, it's trite to say juxtaposition is important to a comic, but I think it is especially true in this one, because they have shit like this page, where it's like a cross, a swastika, a peace sign, and you read across and you get a little row of, like, here's a crusader, and he says, I just want to fuck. Here's a Nazi, and he says, I do not care who, and the peace sign, and some hippie, and it's like, could even be fat or ugly. And that's a repetition, yeah, of what the punks say on an earlier page. So, real highbrow stuff.
We're all the same. We're all, is that, or can I be bold and say that he's comparing everybody to Nazis? And, or he's comparing...
He's certainly making explicit comparisons between certain kinds of self-presentation and other kinds of self-presentation, and saying that underneath that, at least some of them are fundamentally united in their desire to fuck.
That's almost beautiful, if it wasn't so stupid.
Thank you for saying what I could not. Because there's, you know, there's parts of this text that I want to engage with, but it's mostly the pure abstractions. The abstractions around the form of panels, and especially abstractions around border contents in panels, and absolutely the not the part where he's like, Nazis wanna fuck, and so do crusaders. Like, that is not something that I want to engage with, even as I think it's valuable to parse out what is being said, what's not being said, and sort of how the text supports that comparison, or if the text just makes that comparison and flattens it there. So let me return to my attempt at branding a lived experience.
Yeah, what was that about? Is he saying that he used to be a punk and now he's not? Or is...
I mean, a lot of this is very fine art worldy, right? Meditations, or at least considerations about what causes a piece of art to operate, what causes a piece of art to cohere, where, when, and from what a piece of art becomes a thing to itself. And of course, nothing is ever really a thing to itself because we live in a social world. Social constructs. But
once you release it, it belongs to everybody.
Or at least you can't control how anybody reads. Like, contrary to Scott McCloud, you can't make anybody do anything. God is dead. That's not really, Scott McCloud doesn't really disagree with that, I don't think. But it's also true that you can't make anybody do anything, so whatever. For instance, Scott McCloud can't stop me from doing really bad, petty readings of his work. So, by attaching my name, by publishing this book, I've given up the luxury of anonymity, the freedom of not being accountable for a body of work. The author can supersede the expectation of ideological homogeneity. It's one of those words that I can't fucking say. Of ideological fucking sameness, and pursue any experience that they desire by being anonymous. By attaching Andrew Burkholder to these pieces, the universal power of ITDN, an acronym which never stood for anything, has been destroyed. Several pieces to that. I do agree that anonymity is a kind of luxury. I certainly think that not being accountable for a body of work is a luxury. I don't necessarily think anybody's holding Andrew Burkholder accountable for this now, even us making what I will cop to being mild fun of some of the things that this text are doing, isn't really holding him accountable.
It's just accountable. That word confuses me. Not like the context, in the context of what he means when he says that.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly implies to me ethical accountability. I don't think there's any use of the word accountable that doesn't at least imply ethics. And especially if someone's going to be like, Nazis want to fuck. There's questions about that. Do I regret that phrasing? Probably not. Should I regret that phrasing? Probably. Is that also kind of what the text is doing? I think so.
That's literally what the text said.
Yeah. So, in some ways, he's saying, I think, that by claiming authorship of the text, he limits its possible readings and limits the reach of the text, or indeed the non-text, to an understanding that hinges on his authorness, in some ways. He's anchored the title to the work, and he's anchored the work to himself. So those sort of reciprocal chains fix some of the readings that could come out of this text. And because it's an abstract text, those kinds of fixings do inform, possibly necessarily, some of the ways that something is going to be read, especially if it's a comic. So the assumption is that it is read. And not in the sense of do a reading to, which you can do to fucking anything. You can do that to a sidewalk. You know, thanks Roland Barthes. But there's an expectation that you, in some ways, engage with it as one would a book. So he's fixed those points rather than letting it be a freewheeling pile of whatever, especially by using an acronym that stands for nothing. So he has fixed that signifier, which was previously a signifier with no signified, except for perhaps signifiedness. Because an acronym says this stands for something, he's saying it stands for nothing, but it's tied to this work and it's tied to me. And none of that is uninteresting, but it does assume a certain potency in the work that I wonder if is able to bear out the aspirations of this introduction.
It's pretty heavy-handed. It's very art worldy.
Yeah, and I like that in a comic. And I think if he didn't also try to fucking push it with his Nazi sex bits, I'm like really fixated on one panel that is a very small part of the process. But given that the comic that came after that is rendered in a like, a very childlike style. It looks like child crayon drawings and involves a dude murdering a dog.
Oh.
And, like, fucking a corpse.
Like a Miike film.
It's, like, fucking something, that's for sure. Given that those things are in it, I think the idea of, like, anonymity and freedom and accountability becomes a little more fraught. And I'm more interested in the ambition that underlies, like, this sequence, where a panel contains an abstract something of a face, and the something face and the panel push back on each other and, you know, and this is all metaphors, but deform across pages. So what reading order happens and what one reads to be happening in the different panels more or less depends on the ability and willingness of the reader to draw entirely visual connections from one panel to the next, some of which it makes sense to impose a fairly descriptive narrative on. The lines become a face, or the face deforms. And in others, narrativizing them is a very loose process. The X becomes two hooks, maybe, or the lines multiply. But it's much harder to see them as anything but a play of forms. So it comes in and out of more representative pieces, and therefore I think invites you to question representation as anything other than a play of forms, or to see how the play of forms creates what you understand to be representation, or how play of forms sometimes has reference and sometimes severs reference in the different levels of sort of recourse to signification that are involved in reading all the time, not just when you're doing screwy abstract shit.
Yeah.
So I'm much, much more interested in that, or in the called Chris, and it just shows you a bunch of different possible Chris's.
I fucks with that.
Yeah, that part's really fun. And it's because it's also very visually abstracted, and it plays a lot with text and lettering and letter forms and the deformation of text forms. Super fun to play with, super fragmented. Much more interesting to me than, like, crayon dude fucks a dead dog.
Yeah. It seems, so, these were not, this is a collection of work, it's not, like, following anything. This is just, like, stuff he picked out.
It's, so it's 10 comics from between 2010 to 2014. Nowhere in the text does he articulate a particular reason for having put these texts together. Unless you want to read the introduction where it talks about the subject isolating itself from the world, places of communication of fusion, the subject and the object, terror, contestation of understanding is the origin of beliefs. And there's that fucking duck shape again. I actually quite like the duck shape. And then it has this illustration of the tunnel of conception, which I suspect if I were better versed in philosophy, I would have a more articulate understanding of what he's referencing there. But at minimum, he's very clearly interested in some semiology type shit. He's interested in representation and signification. Or indeed possibly significance.
What does it all mean?
What does it mean? Yeah. That type shit. So, not stuff that's alien to a fine arts context. Stuff that's still being parsed through by, like, deconstructionists and shit. So, neat that it's happening in comics. Probably valuable that it's happening this explicitly in comics. And that there is this strong connection being made between sort of deconstruction and meaning in a fine arts context and this comic. As always, I wish people were less compelled to push things that are fraught in an ethical sense when they're pushing things that are fraught in a communicative meaning sense.
I don't think you need to have a panel about Crusaders and Nazis fucking, or about, you know, a terrified arts couple being menaced by jackasses in dead Kennedy's shirts, and, like, maybe they're gonna rape you. I don't think you need that in order to make an interesting work about meaning. I don't think you have to push into this highly charged area when you're already dealing with something that's highly charged. What the fuck is meaning? I think it's just titillation, which is frustrating to me, because these issues are serious and interesting enough on their own. It's a delightful play to be like, what's a form? What's the inside? What's the outside? And I realize, fucking, I just got finished reading Eve Sedgwick. So, like, what's the inside? What's the outside? For some people, that's about fucking, but I don't see that it has to be.
I think I get what you're saying. Yeah. It's sort of shock value mixed in with critique on presentation of self.
I think it's shocking enough to say, like, what's the deal with letter forms? Like, that is a pleasant little shock. It's not a pleasant little shock to be like, I just want to fuck. They could be ugly. I don't care. Like, that's not... You don't need that connection to something that is true and awful to be interested in something that is conceptually true enough and exciting. Like, you don't need that frisson of being like, haha, Crusaders! Or whatever. Like, it doesn't feel like the brave choice to me. It feels like something that people are fairly comfortable having represented as shocking, although it's becoming increasingly tense, obviously, now that we have literal fucking neo-Nazis in the streets. But something that's still fairly comfortable for people to be shocked by, and using that to sort of spice up these conceptual issues.
Just Nazis for the sake of Nazis.
A bit. And I don't know if that's fair. Certainly Nazis are a powerful signifier. But in this case, it doesn't feel like they're doing anything more than, like, pointing at horror. So it doesn't feel like the strongest choice. It just feels like a choice to be shocking to be shocking. And that's always disappointing to me. And it's more disappointing to me in something that is otherwise very interesting and very strong. Even the introduction that I was making a little bit of fun of, it is really fun and interesting and exciting. And Burkholder is very good at it. And Burkholder is clearly very familiar with the fine arts context around it. So it's a little disappointing to me that, I don't know, this isn't everybody's take, but I feel like if you're going to introduce Nazis, you have to have a real strong reason to introduce Nazis. And if you're going to introduce rape, you better have a real strong reason to introduce rape. And I didn't feel like that was met. I don't think those conditions were met by this text necessarily, and I would be interested to be proven wrong or to hear an alternate claim. But since you haven't read the book, you can't really supply that, and I don't think your sort of stance on including things that are awful in a context that is not, like, Grindhouse is that different.
Yeah, there's no good way to say what I'm about to say.
Okay, that's cool. This is the trades. This is an anarchy.
There's a time and place for horrible things and stories, but if it is not furthering, even if it is on, if it's not furthering an idea or, like, a development of a story or character, it's just sort of throwing, it's like throwing paint at a canvas for no reason and saying it's art.
I mean, I love throwing paint at a canvas for no reason and saying it's art, but I, you know, there's a difference between throwing paint and throwing Nazis.
There is a big difference.
Although, if you want to throw a Nazi at a canvas, you know, hopefully the Nazi doesn't survive it, is my take on that.
Hot takes. Mm. Less Nazis, more pain.
Listen, it has been a shit ass of a week for me personally and for comics on the whole. So if the worst thing we're saying today is throw Nazis for a reason, we're not doing bad, really.
This is, pretty classy. I would say a part of me is very like, Nazis only belong in Captain America, or like, Nazis only belong in stories about World War II, where like, like if it was a comic about Nazis, I could see there being a reason for it, but it's just sort of like, hey, check this out. And it's like, oh, all right.
Yeah, it feels like it's a reduction, and we talk in comics and cartooning a lot about what reductions are, and arguably an abstraction is in part a reduction from, even though I don't think that's usually true, because you add and exaggerate and play in a lot of ways when you're doing abstraction, but one kind of abstraction is, like, arguably reducing complexity. An outline is an abstraction from the real thing or whatever.
Okay, yeah.
And that's not a wholly sufficient thing, but it's like a working, it's a working argument, maybe. And the whole thing of fucking Nazis is so awful and so current, that using it in a way that doesn't adequately engage with what that is, both the historical atrocity, and the sort of ghosts and resurrection and lingering traumas of that, that using it in a way that's not about that doesn't feel right to me, and doesn't feel necessary or valuable. It feels like a distraction. It feels like if you don't think your core thing is interesting enough, and that's what I meant by it doesn't feel like the brave choice. If you don't think your abstraction is interesting enough, you throw that shock in there, divorced from its most adequate context. And then I do want to hear about the other comic you read, but that does make me want to nudge very briefly into one of the two big comics controversies that have happened in the last fucking week.
It's just not been a good year for making good choices.
Yeah, it's only July. It's only July. So, Howard Chaykin's Divided States of Hysteria. Have you been following at all?
No, I'm gonna need Howard Shanks' Divided Witness.
Howard Chaykin's Divided States of Hysteria.
Okay.
So, the pitch for issue one from Image was, an America sundered, an America enraged, an America terrified. An America shattered by greed and racism, violence and fear, nihilism and tragedy. And that's when everything really goes to hell. And my understanding is the premise is a, like, what if the future but more so? Or, like, what if the current but more so? What if there was 9/11 too? Which, like, is never a story that I find particularly useful from someone who wants to tell shocking stories. I think anyone who's telling that story and they want to be like, wake up, sheeple, is not telling that story in a way that feels compassionate to me. Because if you feel like you need to exaggerate what's happening right now to shock people, you're the one who has not been paying attention.
Yeah, it's sophistry.
Yeah, yeah. And I, you know, I don't want to get emotional ever in my life. End of story.
It's too late. Just embrace it. Just unleash the beast.
But I think it was in poor taste to start from the premise that what matters is divisions in the abstract in America, because the divisions in America are, of course, historical divisions from the white supremacy which founded this nation. So to say, you know, oh no, it's the divided states of hysteria now, without reading the story, which I am not interested in doing, I wonder to what extent a story that talks about America shattered, as if there was previously a whole America that was somehow not founded on plural genocides is unreasonable. So, and, you know, bordering on or threatening the border of exploitation.
It definitely seems exploitive.
Yeah.
Because it's basically torture porn, is what it looks like.
That's my understanding.
People who are being tortured are minorities, trans people, people of color. It seems like it's a comic book about an old white dude figuring out that not everybody is equal, and he's going to show everybody, like you said, like he's doing the wake up sheeple thing about things that are very, very prominent and very obvious.
People have been writing on the nightmarish violence of America since America was founded. And, you know, for someone to now say that the best way to respond to the current political climate is with torture porn doesn't feel like it has an interest in justice. So this is where the controversy starts. And the controversy comes up with the cover of number 4, but I want to first hit on the cover of number 3, which is a lady back to us, scanty American flag underpants, covered in what are presumably tattoos of just a bunch of fucking symbols. There's a swastika, there's a Star of David. There's a cross. There's also a full set, like all the symbols from a deck of cards. There's a radiation symbol. Looks to be two different crescent, moon, and stars. One is a tramp stamp, so that's respectful. And many, many more. Some white supremacist symbols, some peace movement symbols. There's a little pentacle on there. The kind of thing that people like to be like, I offend everyone equally. The kind of shit they like to do. But we're obviously not everything on that person's body is equally threatened. And some of it is explicitly only threatening. So it's, you know, it's the kind of middle school art project where if you're like, I want to take symbols that are really powerful, and I just want to juxtapose those. I want to take them out of their context and put them together. It's like if someone combined sexual exploitation and a coexist bumper sticker, but believed that Nazis were part of that somehow.
Wow.
I'm fairly upset about it. In case that was not coming through, I was not pleased to see this. And you know, the Star of David and the swastika aren't about the same point on the person's body, but on different arms. They're both just above the elbow, which gives them a similar visual weight and visual significance, which is notable because the Nazis literally waged a campaign of genocidal extermination against Jewish people. So,
yeah, I'm looking at the cover of the hanged Pakistani man.
That is the one that caused the controversy. That's number 4. So I wanted to touch on number 3 because I think it represents to me the logic that went into doing the cover of number 4, which is the one that that people spoke out about more.
It's pretty rough. So all the covers are just this, just showing either victims or, yeah, it just seems like a comic about victimizing.
That's my understanding of it, yes. So, number 4 comes along, and to me, it feels like it's operating in the same logic as the, like, half-naked chick covered in various mostly religious symbols. where it took an image that it knew was shocking and iconic, and it put it in a relationship with a joke. Free happy ending with any home-style meal is the bit of text behind the lynched Pakistani man.
Yeah.
So...
not tasteful.
It is not. Yeah, so it felt like he thought, oh, what's a symbol that's really potent right now? Pakistani dude being hanged. Which, like, you can't divorce from a history of hate crimes and lynching in the United States. And, like, lynching postcards, too. There's a whole history of visual representations of that specific kind of murder that this feels like it's trading in, whether deliberately or not. To say, like, oh, this is bad, but, like, here it is as a joke, or as part of a joke. But, I mean, you're a comedian. I used to be a comedian.
You're still a comic. You never not.
Don't say that. I want to believe that the curse can be broken. That's not how you build a joke about that kind of thing if you're not just being shocking and if you're not just taking shocking images for the sake of being shocking.
I'm sort of like taken aback at how, I mean, the whole thing is like, it's gross, but I'm just, who is this? When I read something, it's like, my main question is like, who is this for?
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem like that comic's for it. It feels like that comic is written for the people that it's trying to say are bad.
Yes.
It feels like it's written for the red pills and the... I don't know the technical... Fuckheads. I don't know. Whatever you want to call them. Bad people in general.
I think fuckhead is very correct. It feels like the kind of thing that's appealing to a fucking Pepe memer. Because it trades in their same iconography of shock and, like, being shocking as a value.
Don't get me wrong. I love gross stuff. I love the shock. I like Shake You Came and the, you know, the giggling maniacs, but... there's a difference between pulp and just...
yeah, I mean, part of the problem is Chaykin is explicitly making a claim that this is a referent to our real life. Like, the real racist violence in the United States. And in this case, specifically Islamophobic violence. Islamophobic racism. So he's trying to point at the violence of the Trump era, whatever that era is going to later be understood to mean, because I don't think it starts with Trump.
Yeah.
Again, it boils down to reference, and like the power that one borrows from reference, from him saying this is an urgent text to rectify or to point out or to wake people up, to red pill people fucking against this thing that's happening. But it's doing it in a way that hurts the people affected, and as you said, appeals to the people who perpetuate it.
The road to hell is paved with good intentions. And I don't even know if the intentions were good in this case.
Yeah, the defense has been like, have you read the book, though? It points out that racism is bad. I'm like, that's... you can claim to be pointing out that racism is bad while being a racist. There's lots and lots and lots of racist ways to be like, racism is bad.
Just read the Nat Turner comic. If you want to read just read any other comic. Read any other comic about those things you claim to care about.
Yeah. Ron Wimberly, who is beloved by both of us, and then also is published by Image, tweeted when that came out, June 30th, a quote, "A, pick up Prince of Cats from Image. I guarantee there are no lynchings in it." You don't have to take my word for it. Hashtag image, hashtag chicken. So that's a response that came out.
You're still great.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow, though.
Yeah, I am constantly in awe of Ron Wimberly. He also tweeted a suggestion that people pick up a copy of Black History in its own words, which he just put out. So, oh wait, here we go. What's more offensive, the lynching imagery or the white mediocrity of that cover? Jesus, that shit is trash. How does that get printed? He also tweeted. So, I agree for what that's worth. I think he's always right, basically. And, like, you're very right to point out that, like, Kyle Baker's Nat Turner comic is important as fuck for, like, alternate engagements with how you write about responses to racist violence and, like, who you prioritize in that and, like, images of horrific violence and, like, how one ethically engages with those problems. Which I should say for our readers is now what Prince of Cats is about. Prince of Cats is a very good Romeo and Juliet, but ninjas and, like, how else would we describe Prince of Cats?
Victorian speech, a lot of fighting and swords. Better than Romeo and Juliet if you're into black people.
Yeah, yeah. Technically Elizabethan speech. I'm sorry, I know I just will actually you, but
I mean, I'm down with learning new things. I'm not a Shakespeare person. I don't get it.
That's really fair. I only like Richard III because I'm not a very good person. Yeah, but it's trivially important, except that Wimberly uses some of the original dialogue from Romeo and Juliet, which would be Elizabethan, because that's when Shakespeare was around. Victorian is like Downton Abbey era. Does not matter very much. Now that I've spent a lot of time well-actualing you, I'm sorry. Let's get back to talking about something else. I'm just going to keep leaning on Maze. You should take over the podcast because I'm just going to snuggle with this cat.
So, hey, it's Aaron. Don't read that comic unless you at least steal it. Don't buy it.
Yeah, direct action. Steal shit.
Image is a great publisher, but the problem with Image is that it's mostly run by dudes, and they get a lot of great content, a lot of open-minded content, but they also get a lot of really toxic, basic scripts, and they make them because they know they're going to get money. Because their flagships are The Walking Dead and the soon-to-be-canceled, or not canceled, the soon-to-be-completed Invincible. I love Image. They're very good. But their main market is Shock.
Yeah, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to talk too much shit, but I do want to talk a certain amount of shit. It is a frustrating situation. So that was the whole Image thing, was people trying to sort that out, trying to figure out what that looked like, and then ultimately getting nowhere, just having a bunch of... the cover got pulled. But, like, Chaykin's gonna do it again. Like, you saw the rest of those covers. He's not gonna stop doing the thing he's doing. He's not gonna get any less Chaykin-y. So, you know, with friends like this, who needs enemies, I guess?
realest thing I ever said.
So, I'm sorry, I was like, I did not warn you that I was gonna drop this subject of discussion. I was like, surprise! It's nightmare time! So I apologize for that.
No, that's great. I mean, it's not great, but I'm glad to be in the know, and now I feel like it's important to talk about it.
Yeah, it is a discussion that happens and then happens over and over again, and will probably keep happening until we're all dead.
Yeah, maybe one there'll be a breaking point, and someone will be like, "You know what? I've had enough. I think everybody can reach a cons. They should just put it on the consensus. Like, are you bored? Are you done with the sexism and the racisms? Are you over it?" And then if everybody's like, "Yeah, we can go from there." We'll think about it. You know, there's going to be someone that's going to be like, "You know what? No, I have not had my fill."
Yeah, they're like, I would like more racism. Maybe don't make that an option. Just have it either like you check yes or you don't check anything. And that's the whole option.
That's the good voter suppression.
You can have 100% participation and still get some absolute unity that way. Fuck. Okay. Do you have more things to say on the subject, or did you want to go on to talk about whatever the other comic that you read was?
I got nothing else to say about it. I feel like everybody knows it's not great.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely part of it, right? Is it's like, what else is there to say at this point?
It's only six issues, so only one more, and then it'll be over. Unless for some reason they're like, "Let's give you a longer run."
Yeah, let's do an ongoing of this shit show. That seems great.
I mean, they made a Planet of the Apes Green Lantern comic.
Oh, yeah. That's true. That's pretty sweet.
There's hope.
Yeah, maybe that should be. Well, no, they would make it bad. The temptation would be to say, you remember how when. Well, I mean, remember in the sense, like, aware of, not like we lived through it, because we're relatively youthful. Despite our like old person style anger. You remember how during the Comics Code era there was that vogue for ape comics, how like every comic had an ape in it, like they had moon apes.
Yeah.
Temptation is to say they should bring that back. They would find a way to make it bad though. Like they definitely would.
Almost immediately. They'd make an ape. They'd just make everybody apes in the DC universe. I'm sure they've done that.
There's no fixing it. Honestly, if any medium is so rotten to its core that you can't fix it by like instituting a one ape minimum quota per title, if you can't reinstall some wacky fun at the heart of a medium with an ape quota, it's irredeemable.
At that point, you're just your heart's dead.
Yeah.
You remember there was a comic where it was a bunch of superheroes, but they were all animals.
Do you mean We Three? Or do you mean like Spider Ham?
I mean Spider-Ham.
Think we have to call the trades there because I don't think it's gonna get any better than that. I think we have to stop there. Thanks so much for listening to The Trades. You can find us on Facebook at The Trades Podcast. You can find us at thetrades.podomatic.com. You can find us on iTunes, and I would appreciate it if you would do so. But however you listen, thank you so much for listening. You're the greatest. Okay, thanks.